y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of murder by stabbing and strangulation, kidnapping, carjacking, and attempted murder. Listener discretion is advised.
On Tuesday, July 23rd, 2013, Edwin Alamany took to the streets of Boston, Massachusetts and attacked three women. Two women survived, but unfortunately, one woman lost her life. Amy Lord had just left her apartment in Southie in the early morning hours on her way to the gym when she was attacked. After forcing Amy to give him her money, he drove her to a remote location and brutally murdered her. After a day of running wild with someone else's money, Edwin attacked Kaylee Ballantyne, who survived her attack and was able to testify at his trial and to put him away for life.
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
Mm-mm. We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear it from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to Killer Queens. We have got a doozy for you. I think we say that almost every time, but this is like legit. I mean, they're all legit a doozy.
But I've like, this is one that like has grabbed me and gripped me so hard.
Yeah. It's incredible. And we want to say thank you as well to Kaylee Ballantyne. So Beth is our writer for this episode. So thank you, Beth. Kaylee actually did a phone interview with her, which was amazing. It is so inspiring to listen to. Allison Foley requested it. Thanks, girl. She lives in that area. So this is making a lot of sense now to me. But like, we were all like messaging each other in Slack, what we use to communicate. And I was just like, I want to be Kaylee Ballantyne when I grow up. Like,
absolutely.
Holy moly.
And like, but we're going to get into it. But like, the strength, the courage, the tenacity, like, God. Mm-hmm.
And the ability to still forgive. Incredible. So,
woo.
This one's got just a lot of angles, you guys. So it's incredible. We are first going to talk about Amy Lord. Amy Beth Lord was born on December 21st, 1988, to Dennis and Cynthia in Springfield, Massachusetts. Their family moved to Wilbraham, where she was raised. Amy had two sisters, Kimberly and Carly. They were all super close. She lived in Wilbraham most of her life and was a member of the dance company since the age of two. She was also a member of St. Cecilia's Church and of the NHS. She graduated in 2007 from Minichog Regional High School. I'm not from there. I don't know if that's how you say it.
Minichog, maybe? I don't know.
Sure. We don't necessarily need to know the pronunciation. Again, we don't live there, so tried my best. But she was the captain of the Falcons cheerleading championship team, and she went to college at Bentley University and graduated in 2011 with a bachelor's degree in marketing and liberal studies. After graduation, she moved to Boston for her job at Genuine Interactive, where she worked for 2 years as an online marketing specialist. Amy had many friends, and they would go by the Gypsies or the Bentley Girls. That's what they were called. It's kind of fun. And Amy had a boyfriend named Mike Castle, who also worked at Genuine Interactive, but on a separate floor.
At 4:23 a.m. on Tuesday, July 23rd, 2013, Edwin Alamany hit Alexandra Cruz in the jaw while she was walking to work at a Dunkin' Donuts in South Boston.
No.
No?
That's just terrible. Like, you're just walking on a sidewalk, and then you get clocked. Oh my gosh.
I know. She briefly went unconscious, and he dragged her into a parking lot. He then choked her and then said if she screamed, he was going to kill her. Alexandra pleaded with Alamany to stop, and he told her, quote, bitch, just know that you're going to die today. Can you imagine?
No, absolutely not.
Alamany turned away from Alexandria and she ran across the street. He told her, quote, I fucked up, and that he had been looking for someone else. And he threw her belongings at her and told her not to call the police because he knew where she worked. Alexandra ran to work, and about an hour later, an officer arrived.
And apparently she spoke to him in Spanish and asked, why are you doing this? And that's when he said, oh, you're not the person I'm looking for. And just, like,
oh, you're Spanish, so.
It definitely seemed to be one of those, like, whoopsie, I didn't mean to do that. I think that's what saved her life.
But, like, who was he fucking looking for? Like, I...
Right.
Shortly after the attack on Alexandra, Alamany attacked Amy Lord in the vestibule of her apartment building at 5:38 a.m., Amy was supposed to meet her friend and coworker, Christina Kelleher, to go to the gym before work that morning, but Amy never showed up. And they were supposed to meet on the bus just before six that morning. It had never happened before. Christina wasn't really worried that Amy hadn't shown up. I mean, Amy was not the kind of person who was not going to be there on time. Like, she was very punctual. But Christina was like, well, maybe she overslept or, you know.
I mean, it is really early. So, you know, everybody accidentally forgets to set an alarm sometime or something.
Sure. And, you know, it's like a one-off thing. Okay, well, I'll just see her at work. It's totally fine.
Right.
So Christina arrives at Genuine Interactive that morning. She began to grow worried when she didn't see Amy at her desk, which was in the same area as hers. And no one else in the office knew where Amy was either. Amy's boyfriend, Mike Castle, had said, or he asked Christina to have Amy message him, but she was like, Amy's not here. Like, I can't ask her that. Mike thought it was weird. And, like, you know, they both were like, this is weird that she's not here. They were kind of like comparing stories, like, it's weird to me. And it's weird to you.
You heard from her. You were supposed to meet her. She's not there. He's thinking, well, I've texted her and, oh, she's working out with Christina. So that's why she's not messaging me back. I'll tell Christina to get her to get in contact with me. And now it's like, okay, well, now we both haven't heard from her. And
exactly. And this is, okay, so 11:30 a.m., Amy's manager ends up calling the police. After learning about Amy and that she was happy with her life, she would not have a reason to leave on her own. A missing persons report was filed right away. The police asked her parents to meet them at her apartment in South Boston at 124 Dorchester.
Dorchester. Street? Don't you think?
Yes, Dorchester. Exactly. The police searched Amy's apartment for any signs of a struggle, but they found nothing that they could go on.
Can I just say, though, that, like, thank you to these police officers for still being like, okay, this is weird. Because how many cases have we covered where it's like, okay, well, we talked to the family. They want to file a missing persons report. There is no reason she'd want to leave on her own, but get over it. She's, however, you know, she's an adult. Doesn't matter how old they are. She's sometimes right. we've even seen that happen with minors, 16 years old, like whatever. They're like, I mean, they can leave if they want to. Actually, no, they can't. They're not supposed to, but she's an adult, whatever. And then they go to the apartment and it doesn't look like anything is wrong.
Right.
How many times have we heard that? Well, there's no signs of, you know, of a struggle, but like that always infuriates me because I'm like, would you see a sign of a struggle if somebody held you at gunpoint and said, walk with me?
Or, no. I mean, in this situation, when you're walking out to go somewhere and somebody just plucks you up and abducts you, like,
exactly.
It's not all of the time going to be this violent struggle.
No.
Like,
no.
And I do commend the police in this situation because they took it very seriously. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
This was great police work, mm-hmm. but a lot of times it's not. So. Yeah. Amy's parents confirmed with the police that she drove a black Jeep Cherokee. And upon hearing this, the police were reminded of a call they received earlier that morning about a car fire.
Ugh.
At about 8:37 that morning, a car fire was reported in South Boston. The car had been fully engulfed in flames when the fire department arrived. They put the fire out and then they towed it for further investigation. At this point, Amy had not yet been reported missing, so they didn't know anything about her disappearance and they didn't know that there was a connection there. But the police confirmed shortly after that the license plate on the burnt vehicle belonged to Amy Lord. The police went back to the station. They started checking Amy's bank records and they found that 5 different ATM transactions had happened the morning of the event, I guess.
Of her disappearance.
Yes. Starting at 6:03 a.m.
Right. So I wonder, is there anything, you know, if I've never done this before, but I've heard that say if you make like multiple Amazon purchases on the same day, your bank might send you a text and say, hey, girl, was that you? Because that's a lot in one day. Why didn't you just do them all at the same time? And sometimes, from what I hear, you don't remember everything that you think you're going to buy on Amazon at one time. And so maybe you do, you know, 3 or 4 in one day. I don't know, but I've heard it. So like, but what I'm wondering is if you're hitting 5
and this is ATMs where you're taking money out.
Yeah. Within just a few hours. I mean, these transactions start at 6 in the morning and they're done by 7:30, 7:45, right? Like it's, I'm just wondering, like, is that not a flag thing?
Because ATMs have a limit on how much you can withdraw at mm-hmm. a time.
Yeah. Right. Now, if it was a flagged thing, who would it tell? Would then you just get a text to your own phone and be like, hey, did you know about this? I don't know what it would do. I'm just wondering because I'm just like, that's obviously very suspicious. A person who, if she needed that much money and couldn't get it all at the ATM at one time, she would walk into a bank and do it in one fell swoop, right? She's not going to go 5 different ATMs.
Well, and I kind of wonder if, and I understand like rights and stuff like that. Like I get it. But in this situation, it would be really beneficial, in my opinion, to have someone who, like if somebody is going to multiple different ATMs within that short of a time
mm-hmm.
to send that to the police.
Right. Yeah. Hey, just check it out. You know, just check it out. I just wonder because, you know, I get.
And I understand that, like, police, they have so much going on. But a welfare check, maybe?
Something, yeah. I just wonder because, like, how many times does something like that happen and it's not.
I don't know what the answer is, but
you
yeah.
Know? Yeah, I guess, I don't know. You guys let us know. Have you ever gone to 5 different ATMs within the span of an hour and a half for any reason? Maybe there is a, like, oh, yeah, that happens because of XYZ, and I just don't know about it. But, you know, just a wonderment.
Yeah. I mean, it is crazy. So the first transaction was at Mount Washington Bank, just down the road from her apartment on Dorchester Street.
Dorchester. Yeah.
It was followed by Metro Credit Union, Bank of America, Sovereign Bank, and Citizens Bank. And investigators contacted each bank and found that all 5 had surveillance cameras at the ATMs. So while the police are working with the banks for the footage, they received a call around 4 p.m. from a cyclist who had found a body at the Stony Brook Reservation in Hyde Park. Mm. The body was of a young woman who had been stabbed and strangled to death, and she was found wearing no clothes and had been stabbed over 40 times. She was on an isolated path in a wooded area, and they were sure this was Amy Lord. Mm-hmm. Based on the photos that they had of her, but there was no ID on the body, obviously. Once confirmed that it was Amy, detectives delivered the news to Amy's family that she had been, in fact, murdered.
Amy's case was no longer a missing person at this point, but a homicide, and the police were hoping that the surveillance video from the banks would get them some leads. The first footage to arrive was from the Bank of America from 6:35 a.m., Amy appears at the ATM alone in workout clothes, and at this point, she appears to be unhurt. She uses her ATM card, and then she leaves. Then they get the Citizens Bank footage from 6:47 a.m., and this ATM is located in a vestibule, and the police see her car outside. She walks in, she does a normal withdrawal, and again, she's alone, and she does not appear to be hurt. However, when the police rewind that video and watch it again, they see that she got back in her vehicle on the passenger side. Okay, so who's driving the car?
Well, yeah, why would she be in the passenger side of her own vehicle?
Right, yeah, that's uncommon.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I can't even count on one hand how many times, or how do I want to say this? I can count on one hand, that's it. The okay. amount of times that I've been in the passenger side of my car in the last 5 years, you know, like, yeah. It's just not common. So, yeah. The third video they get is from Sovereign Bank at 6:40 a.m. And also, these are 6:35, 6:40, 6:47, you know, like, I mean, just bam, 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 hitting everyone you can get to. Mm-hmm. This one's at 6:40 a.m. They see Amy and they see that she does have an injury to her face and on her eyes and nose. It's clear at this point that she has been assaulted. So they see that she looks terrified too, but she doesn't try to run. She gets back in her vehicle. At this point, the police ask Amy's family if they knew of anyone who maybe had a problem with Amy. Is there somebody who might have wanted to hurt her or anything like that? But there was no one that anybody could think of. They review the footage from the Metro Credit Union from 6:10 a.m. So this is half an hour prior to being at Sovereign Bank. This time, the footage is on the driver's side of the vehicle, and they see Amy lean over the driver to use the ATM. They see the driver in the front seat, but this person stays out of the camera's view, of course. Again, they see that Amy's left eye is swollen, and then they see a flash and can see that the driver is a male, but they can't make out really any more than that because his face is covered. Investigators are starting to put a timeline together when they get the footage from the first ATM stop at Mount Washington Bank. So this bank was about a mile from Amy's apartment, and they arrived there at 6:03. The car pulls up, but the driver sees that there is a camera, so he backs up, covers his face, and then pulls back up to the ATM, which, like, duh, they all have cameras. Like,
yeah.
But he was surprised at that one, so whatever.
Whoops.
Yeah, like, oh, God, do they have cameras here? Is that a thing? So when Amy leans over to use the ATM, the police can see that Amy had already been beaten at that point. They see the driver had a t-shirt over his face and his hat brim down. At one point, he actually adjusts his hat and they can see that his head is shaved. When she's finished with the transaction, the driver backs out and heads east. So now that they've got a timeline, they know now she was abducted prior to that 6:03 a.m. withdrawal.
It's so sad too, because like she had the plans. She was going to be there. She was headed out to meet Christina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and what's kind of shocking to me about this too is it's 6 in the morning, 6:45 in the morning, you know, like we're getting close. I mean, that's, I'm not going to say that's broad daylight, but
it's a busy time of day.
I don't feel unsafe walking to my car at, you know, like it just seems like there would be enough people out and about by then. Maybe at 5:40, there's not as many people out and it's probably still dark. But now we're hitting ATMs at 6:47 a.m. There's got to be a lot more people around.
7 a.m., people are starting to at least get ready for work, at most leaving for work. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, yeah, a lot of people, especially in a big town like this, you know, the traffic's got to be really bad. I mean, even here, you've got people that are commuting over an hour to get to work. So,
it's bold.
I know.
Honestly.
Yeah. So, they go back to her apartment and they're looking for cameras around there because they know that she had to have been approached, abducted before this. There's no camera on her building, but there was one across the street to the right facing the parking lot. So they retrieved this footage. Also, as you can tell, there's a lot of surveillance footage in this case, which is the exception rather than the rule, because usually the cameras are like, we don't work and whatever. But so there is an episode of See No Evil on this. There's also an episode of, it was called Impact of Murder.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called I Speak for Amy, that episode.
Yes.
But there is a lot of footage. So that's definitely very helpful to the investigation. But they go and they get that footage and they see a person walk by the door of Amy's apartment, stop. And then when the door opens, they push through and enter the building and they push Amy back inside. The door closes and there's about 15 minutes where the person is in the hallway and the police have no idea what happened inside, obviously. Then two people come out and they head in the opposite direction and out of view to where Amy's car had been parked. And that's about 5:52 a.m. That is also very bold. That's a lot of time to be in that hallway where anybody could have come down
100%
to leave.
Yeah.
Like, it's just wild. I mean,
mm-hmm.
So the police now know that Amy was abducted, her car was burned, and her body was found at Hyde Park. They know that the suspect had to drive 5 miles to Hyde Park and then back to Southie where her car was found burning.
Side note.
Yes.
So sorry. I didn't know that Southie was a place. I thought it was like a term for people who live like on the south side or something like that.
Oh, right. Yeah, because the
town. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, but people call Southie is a place, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They've referred to, yeah, everybody just called it Southie. It's kind of fun.
I like it. I'm just, like, yeah, it. Yeah. No, I like it.
So they start looking for gas stations where this person could have bought the gas to start the fire. They checked all the intersections along the route, but there were hundreds. I mean, oof. So they know that Amy had a black SUV, but again, a lot of those around. So as they're looking through the intersection footage, they remembered that Amy had a sticker on her rear window. So they start focusing on Hyde Park and Logan Way, and they see Amy's Jeep on Washington Street. So a police officer went to the gas station at that intersection to try to get surveillance video, but that system was broken. But the officer saw that there was a liquor store across the street that had cameras. So he went over and asked if they had any footage. The officer watched the footage and saw Amy's Jeep pull up at 8 a.m. And he knew it was Amy's because of her shamrock sticker on her back window. He sees the driver get out of the vehicle, but it was too far away for him to make out who it could be. The driver then walks away from the car and walks across the street where he greets someone that he knows. There are just so many instances in this case where once we figure out who this person is, I mean, it is undeniable that we're placing him at all these things. Because normally, if you just have surveillance footage, well, that's grainy. Could it be him? Could it be somebody else that looks like him? We don't know. But he sees somebody he personally knows. And now we've got somebody who's going to be able to place him there at that same time in a girl's car who's been murdered and it's been burned. Like, come on.
Well, and that's not even the half of it, but yes.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. So eventually the police were able to find the man that he met with and they ask him, who did you talk to? And he says, oh, well, that's Edwin Alamany. So they're working through all this. They're getting all this footage. They're doing all these things. The police receive a call just after midnight, and it was a call about a stabbing at 57 Gate Street in South Boston, which is very close to Amy's apartment.
It's blocks away.
Yeah. You could walk there. It's super close.
I think this is like 200 yards.
Some amount of yards. Yeah. I mean, they could walk it. Yeah. So the police were immediately like, oh my gosh, do we have like a serial attacker murderer out on the loose right now? So detectives Paul McLaughlin and Bobby Flynn were in the entryway of Amy's apartment processing the scene at her front door area. And earlier that day, Detective McLaughlin had pulled a photo from arrest records based on the description that Alexandra had given them early that morning. Because this is not, like, how many people is he going to attack today?
Well, and McLaughlin needs to, like, I don't know what he needs, but he fucking nailed it.
Nailed it. Yeah, exactly. So he shows it to Detective Flynn to let him know that this could potentially be their guy. They're looking at the photo and then they receive a call that there's a stabbing at 57 Gate Street. Oh, 500 yards away.
500 yards. Yeah.
The victim of this attack was 21-year-old Kaylee Ballantyne.
Kaylee Ballantyne grew up in Gorham, Maine with her parents and two older brothers. And she was the youngest and the only girl. So it was obviously she's got two older brothers. She's an easy target, right? The only girl, the youngest.
They picked on her.
100%. But she learned how to stick up for herself. Her mom, Kim, said that as a child, Kaylee always had the spirit of a fighter and that she wasn't somebody who was going to be taken advantage of. Kaylee and both of her brothers grew up playing sports. In 2003, when Kaylee was 11, she had her first near-death experience. She had been lowering a basketball backboard when it hit her in the head and she was in a coma for 3 weeks. Kaylee persevered through this experience. She went on to play Division I field hockey at Bryant University in Rhode Island. The summer before her senior year of college, Kaylee took an unpaid internship in Boston. She moved into an apartment in Southie with her friends from college that had graduated from Bryant before her. And this internship was unpaid, so she ended up getting a hostess job on the other side of Boston where she lived. And she took the T, which is, I guess, like a...
I guess what they call their
subway.
Train.
It's a train. Yeah. Yes. To and from work. And she said that she typically worked the night shift. So she was there from like 5 p.m. to 11, midnight, something like that. So the night of July 23rd, 2013, it's, as we've heard before, it's not an unusual night. It was like anything they've ever, you know...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it just puts into perspective, like, today, I would say for most of us, we woke up and it's just like any other day, right? You literally don't know what is going to happen in the course of a day. Ugh.
I know. Kaylee explained that Southie is a young, vibrant area of Boston. It's well lit with people typically out and about. And she had her headphones in, which everybody should be able to walk around no matter what time of day, no matter what gender, no matter what sexual orientation, whatever you are, you should be able to walk around with headphones in and be safe.
Yep.
But no. Okay, so that's what she's doing. She's making her way to an apartment, or her apartment, excuse me. And so she's getting near her apartment, and she noticed a man that was walking on the other side of the street, and he's walking the opposite direction. The side that the man was on was the side of the street that her apartment is on. And she's going to have to cross the street to get to her apartment. So they get to the crosswalk at the same exact time. And she said that she noticed that he, when she crosses, he starts to walk and then he takes a step back. And she clocks that as like something weird, obviously. Mm-hmm. And she remembers him watching her for about 5 seconds. Then he continues to cross the street. So she gets to her apartment and they have a little key code thing that you have to use to get into the apartment. She types it wrong the first time, and then the second time she gets it. She's going into her apartment and he comes up behind her with a knife to her head. He put his hand on her left shoulder. He pushed her through the door. And Kaylee says that she remembers thinking, this is not happening. I'm not going to die here. And she said, quote, I'm going to fuck this guy up. It's exactly, God bless her. That's exactly what she did.
That's exactly what she did.
He pushed her to the ground in the foyer and her back was on the first few steps leading upstairs where her apartment would be. It was on the ground floor. He was straddling her. And she was wearing a crossbody purse and she told him, like, take my money, take my phone, anything you want. Please don't kill me. He didn't look up. He didn't say anything. He just started stabbing her. Kaylee crossed her left arm over her chest to protect her organs, and she immediately started to fight back. And she was kicking. She was trying to hit him with her right arm. She was saying that she was in the best. Okay. She's a field hockey player.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know this, but I think, isn't Division One like the best division? Is it like the smaller numbers are the better? Like,
you would know more of this than me. Like, I don't know.
I mean, either way, I guess it doesn't matter. Yeah, what division. But yeah, she's working out all the time. She is an active player on a college team.
And I think she was up for head coach or solo coach or something. Or not coach. What do you call it? Captain?
Captain. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's an athletic person who's in shape.
Muscles and fitness, that was her hobby. So she was strong as fuck.
Mm-hmm.
So she was able to fight him hard. And while she was kicking him, she ended up kicking the hand that he had the knife in, and he ended up stabbing himself. And she says that it wasn't a conscious thing. She didn't necessarily like plan to do that, but
yeah,
she was just kicking and fighting as hard as she could at the time. And she had no idea that he stabbed himself. Her attacker, he falls back and he just walks away. He just leaves.
Just gets up and leaves.
Mm-hmm. He GTFO'd. So when he left, Kaylee slammed the door behind him so he couldn't get back in. And she recalls that she did not know how many times she had been stabbed. She didn't really feel it when it was happening, which is a very common account of a stabbing, like a survivor of a stabbing.
Yeah.
They have no idea that they have been stabbed.
No, it's your adrenaline, I guess, just kicks in and it's just like, yeah.
Yeah. So she tries to stand up, but she collapsed and her chest was tight. And she was thinking, was it her adrenaline? Was she dying? But she knew she needed to get into her apartment. Kaylee said that for some reason, the key to her apartment was in her pocket, which made it much easier for her to get in. So she crawls to her apartment door. She unlocks it and she goes inside. When she's in there, she crawled to her first roommate's room and told her that she had just gotten stabbed. She needed to get towels, paper towels, anything to suture the wounds. And then you got to call 911. And Kaylee recalls telling her roommate that she wanted her to call her other roommate and her dad to let them know what happened. But her roommate told her, we need to get you an ambulance.
I mean, she's literally just like, okay, we've got some phone calls to make here. We've got to do this. Like, I need you to get that. And her roommate's like, I'm calling 911. Like, we'll call everybody, but let's call 911 first.
Yeah. This is, okay, I love where your head's at, first of all. It's amazing. But you're in a lot of pain and it's dire. Yeah. Need to get to, yeah. So
let's go ambulance first.
Yeah.
What a just like calm head she maintained through this whole thing, though. Like, it's just incredible. Like, she's just like, I got shit to do.
Yeah. Okay. So I thought about this while I was researching, and you know, I know that I have never, ever, ever been in a situation like this, but I will say, on a teeny tiny minuscule level, I shattered my nose when I was in the seventh grade. And I remember, and I don't know if this is what it would have been like for her, but I remember kind of my body went into autopilot because I was in and out of consciousness at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And my body was just like, okay, get to the house. It, like, I don't even remember like making a decision of like, we have to go here.
Mm-hmm.
But my body was propelled in that position.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah,
that direction. So I wonder if, I mean, I can't, again, I cannot even fathom what it was like for her because this is life and death. Versus me being like, it was a lot of pain and there was blood loss, but I wasn't going to die right. from yeah. it, you know?
Yeah. It's really incredible. Like, our brains are literally...
muscle memory kind of thing?
Created to survive. Like, they are... That's why we get scared of things. That's why we have anxiety. And sometimes our body, you know, our brain can't tell the difference between, am I really, you know, in life-threatening danger or not? But... that our brain is designed to, okay, like your brain said, all the help was in the house. So get mm-hmm. to the house, you know, like, yeah, it's just incredible.
It is. And I think we don't give ourselves enough credit because, I mean, me as a person, I'm like, I could never survive this. Like I could, what Kaylee went through, I could never survive it. But again, on a teeny tiny little small scale, I was like, well, I got my ass up and got into the house. I crawled, clawed my way up there after passing mm-hmm. out, what, yeah. twice? Like, you know?
Well, yeah. And I will say, like, after hearing Kaylee's story and also, like, hearing her, you know, talk with Beth, and because we were able to, you know, she gave Beth the go-ahead to record it, and we were able to listen to that conversation afterwards as well. She makes you feel like you can do anything. You know what I mean? Like,
absolutely. She is such an inspiration. She is such a fighter. She is such, like, you said it best. You said, I want to be Kaylee when I grow up. And
just everything, her attitude, her composure, her inspiration. Yeah, just all of it. She's great.
Mm-hmm.
She's great.
Yep. I love it. Ugh. Okay, so let's get back to the incident. Her attacker had stabbed her in the left torso, which caused her left lung to collapse, and she was also stabbed below her left breast, about a half an inch from her heart. She had also been stabbed twice in the face and been slashed on her neck, and in total, Kaylee had 9 stab wounds.
And the detective, I think it was Flynn, said, you can see where her stab wounds were.
They're so localized.
They're very localized to the area of her heart. And he was like, this guy was trying to kill her. His mm-hmm. goal was to kill her. There's no doubt about it.
Absolutely.
I mean.
So because Kaylee's apartment was only about a block away from Amy's apartment, the officers that were there at the time of the call, they made it to Kaylee's very quickly. The ambulance also arrived within 5 minutes of the call. And before being taken to the hospital, she was asked to give a description of her attacker, and she told the officers that the man had shorts on, he had a t-shirt on, he had a flat brim hat low on his face, a buzz cut, and looked Hispanic. Does this sound familiar to you?
Mm-hmm.
As the detectives were at Kayla's apartment and she was on her way to Tufts Medical Center, they noticed a blood trail leading away from her apartment. So they followed the trail and they're like, well, hang on a second. She was attacked in the foyer of her apartment. Why is the blood going in an opposite direction?
She never left.
Must be the suspect's blood. They followed the trail, but they were also looking for any surveillance cameras that they could use to identify their suspect. But then the blood trail ends abruptly. They took samples of the blood to be tested, but they also found that there was a camera on a building where the trail had ended. Luckily, the camera worked. Shocking. And recorded a man with something that was later identified as his shirt. So he was wearing a white t-shirt or something light colored. He had taken it off. He wrapped it around the hand that had been stabbed. And the police enlisted the help of John Green, a forensic video expert, to look at the man's exposed tattoos after he had removed his t-shirt. This was something that I found very, very ironic, might not be the right word, but I don't know. He had praying hands,
right? Yeah,
with rosary beads,
of course.
After he has attempted to murder someone, and a Boston Red Sox B with the area code 617 below it. That's neither here nor there. But the praying hands, the rosary beads, like, really?
I know. Yeah.
So Detective Flynn called Kim, Kaylee's mother, to inform her that her daughter had been stabbed. And Kim was at the parents' summer home with her husband, Mike. So she had gotten up, she went to the bathroom, and her phone rang. So she missed the call. But when she saw the 617 number, she knew that it was about Kaylee, and she had a terrible feeling about it. And she was thinking, quote, something bad has happened. I know something bad has happened. So she called the number back, and she heard, your daughter has been stabbed.
Oh, my gosh.
Kim was obviously immediately hysterical, and she was told by Detective Flynn that someone would call her back with more details. I cannot even imagine, like, you know that something bad has happened, but they're like, we can't tell you anything, but, you know,
And she was asking, like, can I talk to her? Let me talk to her. And they're like, no, you can't talk to her right now. She's in the emergency room and they're working on her, but she has no status whatsoever. Like she's going to recover and they're just stitching her up or...
Right.
Oh my gosh, I can't imagine.
So Kim and Mike got in the car and drove 3 hours to Boston immediately. And Kim kept thinking, like, you know, I don't know how bad Kaylee's hurt. And is she going to live through this? So Kim said that so many strange thoughts had gone through her head, wondering, was the man a stalker? She was worried about, like, you know, if he knew that she had survived this, what's going to happen? Is he going to come back and try to, like, finish her off, obviously? So while Kaylee was being worked on, Detective Flynn got a call saying that he believed her attacker was also in the same hospital while she's there in the emergency room.
The nerve, the nerve. He's like, ow, I need to go to the hospital. I mean, now his stab was, it wasn't like his hand slipped and he kind of sliced a little bit and it was something he could deal with at home. I mean, he had a pretty good stab wound there, but I'm just like, are you serious right now? But I mean, I'm also assuming he did not expect her to live.
Oh, 100%. And guess what? Actions have consequences.
Sure do.
So, sorry, not sorry. So Detective Flynn, he finds this out and he goes into Kaylee's room and he introduces himself and Kaylee grabs his arm and she was like, quote, I'm telling you, if I didn't, well, she didn't say this. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
He said, I'm telling you, if I didn't know it was Kaylee Ballantyne, I would have thought it was Haystack Calhoun that grabbed me because she had a death grip on me. I didn't know who Haystack Calhoun was, but apparently, or is, he is a professional American arm wrestler. I didn't even know that was a thing.
I didn't know that was a thing either, but I mean, I'm assuming that guy's got a grip, so.
Right. So Kaylee asked Detective Flynn, is my attacker here? I heard someone say that he might be here, like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine? Like when I read that he was there at the hospital, at the same hospital that she was at, and she's almost lost her life to this man, I was like, oh my gosh. Like I was like, I can't imagine.
When I tell you the first thing that I watched on this, it was like this the entire time. It was like, no.
Oh my gosh.
Oh God. So while interviewing the man who was identified as Edwin Alamany, he initially denied any involvement in Kaylee's attack. And he was like, oh, I don't remember. I just really don't remember.
Yeah, they're like, how did you get into her apartment? I don't remember. How did you come across her? I don't remember. I don't remember. What did you do before
What did you have for lunch that day?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember
that. Oh, it was this and this and that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He remembered everything before and after the attack. Nothing during the attack, which, I mean... convenient.
Yep. It's a bold move, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off.
Exactly. The detectives were able to use his tattoos to positively identify him as the man in the surveillance footage. And at this point, Edwin Alamany was arrested for Kaylee's attack, but they didn't have enough evidence to link him to Amy's murder. So shortly after his arrest, they were able to forensically match the blood.
You guys.
Okay, so he had gone home. He changed his clothes after murdering Amy, but kept the same shoes on. His shoes had both Amy and Kaylee's blood on them.
Sucks to suck.
Thank God for dumb criminals. And his blood was also on Kaylee's clothes from when she had kicked his hand and he stabbed himself.
Whoops.
Kaylee's mom. She's a boss. Kaylee's mom got to the hospital at about 5 a.m. She immediately hugged her daughter. She told her everything was going to be okay. And Kim said in an interview on Impact of Murder, quote, "You don't understand why or how somebody could do this to your child." Mm-hmm. And oh my gosh, her mom, her parents are so sweet.
They're precious. They really are.
But everybody in that family is so adorable. The detectives decided, they were like, okay, we're not going to tell her about Amy Lord's murder. They waited like 3 to 4 days, but Kaylee is in the hospital. She's watching TV and she sees something on the TV.
Yeah.
And she asks them like, hey, I saw this. And they ended up telling her. Detective Flynn told her. And she said, quote, "I went from feeling strong and grateful and lucky that I had fought back to, you know, feeling like I didn't deserve any feeling because she didn't get that opportunity."
That is just so heartbreaking. That is so heartbreaking.
I understand it, but in my position, like I could never put myself in her position. In my position, she should never feel guilty.
Yeah.
It's not her fault.
Right.
You know who should feel guilty? Edwin Alamany.
Yeah. And survivor's guilt is such, I mean, it's a thing, man. And it's a tough thing to get through. I mean, that's, so you've got all of these things that Kaylee has to overcome and live with now. Like the fact that somebody tried to murder her, you know, there's PTSD with all of that. And then you've got, absolutely. Oh my gosh, he killed somebody else. Like,
well, and I think, I mean, obviously there is no discounting any part of her road to recovery on any of it. Like the emotional, the mental, all of that. Let's talk about the physical recovery. She had a collapsed lung.
Right.
She was stabbed 9 times.
Yeah. I mean, just, oh my gosh. Yeah.
And I understand, again, I can see where, because it's, I think it's human of us to be like, why did I live in someone, you know, like,
yeah,
it's not fair, but it is, you know,
mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's like, oh, but no,
yeah,
it's not your fault.
Right.
So additional surveillance videos found of Alamany showed that he used Amy's money to buy a cell phone and beer.
Of course.
They also saw him hanging out with friends at a restaurant. He went to a Chinese restaurant. He did not buy a loaf of bread.
Mm-mm.
He was hanging out.
Have fun.
He was hanging out with his fucking friends, and all of this is between the time of him murdering Amy and then attacking Kaylee. And then he took a hospital. He took a taxi to the hospital, and there's also footage of him in a gas station where he told the attendant that someone had stabbed him.
Yeah, and he tried to make it like, oh my gosh, somebody like just ran up and attacked me. Like, I don't know what happened. It's crazy.
Sucks. I don't like it.
Poor guy. So Alamany was charged with first degree murder, kidnapping, armed carjacking, 2 counts of armed robbery, 2 counts of armed robbery while being masked, stealing by confining, arson of a motor vehicle, and other assault related offenses. It was then found that he had been indicted for 3 attacks on other young women in Boston in September 2012 and July 2013.
What the fuck is wrong with this guy? Why?
Yeah. After a review of the September 2012 case, Detective Jerome Hall Brewster was demoted to patrolman because they had found that he had failed to move forward in a sexual assault case where Edwin Alamany had been the prime suspect. There had been probable cause to arrest him after the woman who had been attacked and had identified him by giving the police. Okay, again, it's not like she said she picked him out of a photo lineup and said, this person attacked me. No.
Because we've talked about the diciness of...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She gave the police a wallet with his ID inside. Pretty strong evidence that it was him, right?
Yeah.
Hall Brewster had been investigated by internal affairs several times and has had at least 10 complaints filed against him. And he's not fired. He's just demoted. Guys, do better.
No, do you know why?
Why?
Because Internal Affairs had investigated him. I'm going to check myself.
Yeah, I think I'm good. My Internal Affairs department is busy. It is always being like, Torella, is that, should you have handled that way? Did you, you know, every time I have a fight with my husband, I'm like, you know what? I'll get Internal Affairs on it. We'll see what the problem is here. We'll get to the bottom of it. And every time they don't find anything wrong.
I'm literally thinking of the movie Inside Out, and I have like, who would play my Internal Affairs agent? Like,
yeah.
Somebody would be there being like, no, I think we're good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think no, you did everything you could do. So that's a them problem, right?
Exactly. Definitely. Fuck that guy. And okay.
Yeah.
We took two steps forward, and now we're learning that we took a step back. Like,
yeah, because he should have been in jail.
Yes. He should have been again, in jail. Preventable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kim said that at Alamany's arraignment, they had not yet met the Lord family, but they had kept turning around to look at Kaylee, and she said she just felt sick about them being there and, you know, obviously what they're going through. And she has said many times, quote, I could be in Cindy Lord's shoes very easily. She said that Kaylee lived through this and she feels incredibly sad that their daughter did not. And I don't know this because I've not heard an interview with Cindy Lord, but I know that she has had contact with them. And I think that the Lord family is probably just incredibly grateful that Kaylee is still here. I don't think that they would view it any other way. Of course, they want their daughter here, but they certainly would not want somebody else to go through that pain too, you know?
They're well, 100%. And I do think that although it is a very, very, very small aspect of closure or justice for him to have been caught because of Kaylee,
mm-hmm.
who knows what kind of rampage he would have gone on if Kaylee had, God forbid, passed away or something. But
yes.
She had a big hand. The biggest hand
yeah.
in him being caught.
Absolutely.
I could imagine that they would, but I also, I just, see, and that's the ripple effect that we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Look at everybody that's affected, that feels guilty for even breathing air.
Yeah. It's sad. It's so sad. I mean, we always say, like, yeah, the perpetrator might get, sometimes they get a life sentence, sometimes they get something more, sometimes they get something less, you know, whatever. Regardless of the, or sometimes they're never caught, regardless of what happens to the perpetrator, the people that are impacted by this crime get a life sentence every single day. Every single day they have to work through it. And it, you know, it's just, you know, it's yeah. not fair.
They don't get credit for time served. They don't right. get like,
yeah, they don't get out. Yeah, exactly. Edwin Alamany's trial did not take place until 2015, 1 year and 10 months after the attacks. The trial lasted 14 days and Kaylee was required to testify. And she actually said that at the trial, she felt really confident and she was excited to get on the stand and tell her story. And at that time, she was very angry as well. So she said while she was on the stand, she wanted him to look at her and she was like staring him down the whole time. And she said he just kind of kept like his head down and he didn't really look up.
The strength.
Mm-hmm.
That she possesses.
Because I can't imagine how terrifying that would be. I wouldn't want to get on the stand, you know, like.
Well, and I feel like if I may, I don't know. But like her energy was like, I dare you, like, look at me.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, she was just like, no, I was ready for this. And she was one of the last witnesses to testify. And the defense only cross-examined her for about 5 minutes, she said, which.
Thank God.
Yes. Because we have seen before defense attorneys get up there and be like, well, what were you wearing? You know, like, yeah, just disgusting stuff. Like, Edwin Alamany was found guilty on the charges of first-degree murder, armed robbery, aggravated assault and battery by means of a dangerous weapon, and attempted murder of both Kaylee Ballantyne and Alexandra Cruz. On June 9th, 2015, Edwin Alamany was sentenced to life without parole for the murder of Amy Lord, plus 35 years for his attacks on Kaylee and Alexandra. At the sentencing hearing, Kaylee was able to make an impact statement. And instead of reading what she'd written down, she just, I mean, she brought a statement up there with her that she had taken time to prepare. She was like, I just ended up speaking from my heart. And she spoke about having to learn to walk again and overcoming her injuries. She told the court that Amy's mom had given her a necklace that Amy also had. and that she would carry Amy with her for the rest of her life. And she said, quote, "She's my guardian angel, and she helped me fight and do what I did, and I'm still here today because she wanted me to be here today. And I speak not only for myself and what's coming out of my heart right now, but I speak for her too." Just
amazing.
Beautiful.
Oh my gosh.
Amy's mother also gave an impact statement at the sentencing, and she said, quote, "The reality for us is there will never truly be closure. There are not words to describe what we lost and how our lives have forever changed. There will always be an unimaginable, unrelenting pain." In October of 2022, Edwin Alamany asked a federal judge to free him on the claim that his trial attorneys were ineffective by going with the insanity defense. He says he was innocent, not insane. In 2021, the state Supreme Judicial Court upheld his conviction, ruling that he had, in fact, gotten a fair trial.
I feel insane listening to this. Like, okay.
Yeah, like, and if, you know, I know that he's talking about they went with legally insane. He didn't know what he was doing at the time. He couldn't tell right from wrong, all that stuff. Well, you're still dangerous, okay? And it wasn't just this one night. Now we've got cases from before that where you've been dangerous. So you're a danger to society either way.
And guess what? You should have been locked up years before this happened. But somebody fucking dropped the ball. So you proved us all right. And now you need to be in jail for forever.
Yeah, you had your chance. And look at what you did with it.
Exactly.
He also petitioned for a writ of habeas corpus, which is a request for a federal judge to order him released immediately, vacate his conviction, and dismiss his indictment.
The audacity.
I mean, he had claimed that his attorneys pursued a criminal responsibility defense acknowledging his guilt after he repeatedly informed them that he didn't want them to do so. He claims that this failure to follow his wishes violated his Sixth Amendment rights. Aww. His current attorney, Andrew S. Crouch, also argued that the error was compounded when a judge refused to hold an evidentiary hearing on the request for a new trial and that a prosecutor made impermissibly inflammatory comments in their opening statement to the jury. The Supreme Judicial Court concluded that while the prosecutor might have gone too far, it wasn't enough to collectively change the minds of the jury, and there was plenty to convict him. He had everyone's blood on him. They had his blood on them. Like, he was seen with Amy's car. Like,
yeah.
Why?
I mean, pick one of them, and if you want to pick that one to be like, that's not fair. Okay, well, we got 17 others, so.
Exactly.
And I think that everybody's rights are, you should have your rights. Like, everybody should. You done fucked up.
You done fucked
Edwin
up.
Edwin Alamany, like,
yeah.
Quit.
Just awful.
Guilty.
Yeah.
After recovering from her injuries, Kaylee went back to college life. She graduated from Bryant University, and she lived in Providence until the trial ended in 2015. Then she moved out to California. She said that she lived in a treehouse to connect with the earth again. Love that for her. She began having dreams about sitting across from Edwin in prison and asking him what happened for him to be in the space where he was capable of doing something like this. She was wondering if she was beginning to feel forgiveness because she was feeling bad about the situation and she did have pity for him, which... She is a bigger, exponentially bigger person than I could ever be. At the same time, though, she hated him for taking an innocent person's life, and she did decide to write a forgiveness letter to Edwin, but it sat in a drawer for about 2 years. So she reached out to the woman's advocate that she had through the court system in regard to sending the letter to Edwin, but she never heard back. She had remained close with the detectives from her case, so she reaches out to Bobby Flynn, one of the one who had been, I feel like, the most contact in
yeah.
the most contact.
Yeah, he was there like every step of the way.
Yes. And he was like, why would you? And he was like, again, it's so sweet. Everybody that we hear from or that I have heard from in this case is so understanding, so loving, comes from a place of good. But they're like, Bobby Flynn is like, I know that how I feel about Edwin Alamany. So coming from me, I'm like, why would you want to reach out to him?
I'll do that. Yeah.
But it's her decision.
Mm-hmm.
So while visiting her parents back in Maine, Kaylee went to church with her mom, and the sermon that day happened to be about forgiveness. Ugh.
I love, like, those are like moments that, like, you get goosebumps or whatever. Like, I know when you go to church and you hear something, like, but there are just some times when you think, God put this in front of me today for a reason, you know? Like,
it's absolutely meant for me.
Yeah.
Yes. The pastor went up to Kaylee after and let her know that if she ever wanted to talk, his door was open. She did end up speaking with him with encouragement from her mom, and it turned out that he did prayers at the prison where Alamany was housed. The pastor helped her locate the caseworker and get her letter to Edwin. 2 weeks later, Kaylee was back in California, and her mom called her to let her know that she received a letter from Edwin Alamany. She still has the letter, and she said that it was super remorseful, told her about his troubled childhood. He was born in Puerto Rico. He moved to the States. He didn't know any English. He had been picked on as a kid. He was in and out of juvie and jail throughout his life. But just a few weeks later, she found out that he had appealed and wondered if his letter back was to make himself look good or if it was genuine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kaylee hopes that he is doing okay and is going to classes and trying to better himself. Again, God bless her.
Yep.
Kaylee said that he didn't ruin her life. He enhanced it. She chose to take the situation. She turned it into something positive. And she says that she is the happiest that she's ever been. Despite this, she does struggle day to day with anxiety and has challenges in daily life. But she goes to therapy. She does the work to stay happy and positive. After living in California for a while, she moved back to Maine, where she still lives today. She was a public speaker working to tell her story in order to help other people who have experienced traumatic events. And about a year ago, she stepped away from her public speaking and is looking for her next step in telling her story. Kaylee says that telling her story is her passion because it could resonate with someone to help make positive changes in their life. And Kaylee, she works in marketing now. She is in a committed relationship with the love of her life, and she recently purchased her new home, her first home.
Congratulations, Kaylee.
Judd, Kaylee, if you listen to this, if you watch it, we both want to be you when we grow up. We are in awe of you. Yeah. Terrell, do you have any words? Like, I don't know what to say. Like,
I know. It's just incredible. And we hope that by, you know, us sharing the story with our audience, however small that may be, that, you know, it just continues to help spread her message of positivity, of forgiveness. You know, she used the saying that, you know, holding on to that hate and holding on to that forgiveness and not letting it happen is like drinking poison, expecting the other person to die. It just does not serve us as humans. And, absolutely. You know, and what did he do with that? I don't know, but she's so mature and just really aware and all the things that, like, what he does with that forgiveness, I can't control. I can't control his reaction to it. He may not give a shit. She said that. He might not care if he gets a letter from me. He may have been using that opportunity to look better on his appeal. We don't know. She's like, but I can't control that. All I can control is that I know that I needed to forgive him for me in order for me to heal and move on. And that's what I'm doing. So he's going to do what he's going to do, but I can control me. And it's just.
And this beautiful. Is why I want to be her. Yeah. I want to have that level of maturity. I don't know, all of the things. I want to be whatever Kaylee is.
Well, and you know, I'm sure a big part of that comes from, like, for me, learning things like that, a big part of it is church for me. I know that Kaylee goes to church too. That's a part of it for her. But she's also in therapy. She's doing the work. I mean, we talk about therapy all the time. We love it. We're big proponents. I saw my therapist 2 days ago. You know, it's just, it really does make a difference. You know, sometimes you don't always find the right person right away and you have to kind of bounce around a little bit till you do. But when you do, when you're doing that work, man, it's just, it makes a big difference.
I do want to say, just kind of side note, which it goes into, I mean, it pertains to what we're talking about, but anger is a very easy emotion to feel. Mm-hmm. It's comfortable for a lot of us. Myself, 100%. I am like the anger queen. I love it. I live for anger. the real work starts when you find the reason behind the anger.
Mm-hmm.
Is it sadness? Is it resent? Is it, you know,
mm-hmm.
betrayal? All the things. And I think that that's really important. And I think that to get around the anger for Kaylee, like, I'm in awe of it.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, what she is talking about or realizing, which I also think is very freeing, is, you know, like she said, I can't control what he's going to do with this. If I write him a letter of forgiveness, he can do whatever he's going to do with it. But people's reactions to you or people's treatment of you says something about them and not you. It's not necessarily because they're out to get you, they don't like you, they don't like the way you look, whatever. Maybe they've said some of those things. But what that says about them is that they're broken. And, you know, like, he attacked her and almost killed her. That's the most hate you would think that somebody could, you know, feel for you. But she didn't let it get into her and be like, well, then I'm not, you know, like, no. What he did says everything about him and nothing about me. Like,
yeah,
that's and just I think a that beautiful that, thing to live out.
Well, and that's a message that we can all carry with us, no matter what situation you're in. Mm-hmm. That is an amazing, I mean, I took away something, like, it resonates with me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So thank you, Kaylee.
Thank you. And thank you so much for hanging out with us. We love you, and we'll catch you on the next episode, hopefully.
Bye.
Bye.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation.
Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye.
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud.
Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.